John Suntress reminding you that today's episode was brought to you by the Summit City Convention happening May 22nd in Fort Wayne, Indiana at the Grand Wayne Center. It's going to be a great day among the people that you can see. Friends of the show like Andy Jewett, Art Balthazar, Chris Burnham, Dave Wachter, Jim Heffron, Steve Bryant, Hillary Barta, Katie Cook, Matt Kent, Mike Norton, Tim Seeley, Robert Atkins. Jim Rugg is going to be there. Looking forward to seeing Jim. This is like Romper Room, where I mention everybody, and it's like I've got the magic mirror happening. Zach Crucy, of course, is going to be there. It's going to be a great day. Dozens of creators will be there, and really some great art. You'll definitely want to be there to check out the Summit City Comic Con. I'm going to be there May 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's being brought to you by our friends at Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, and InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. If you're in the tri-state area, you'll want to check it out. The Summit City Comic Con, May 22nd at the Grand Wayne Center in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hope to see you there. In association with iFanboy, welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. I point out the association and the welcome part of that introduction for two reasons. One, to truly welcome new listeners who might be coming from iFanboy.com and the iFanboy family of listeners. Thanks if this is your first time for listening. But also to explain the association that Word Balloon now has with iFanboy. It's very similar to what we used to have with Newsarama, that it's an arrangement to post the shows over at iFanboy, add to their content, but still maintain our own identity as well. Very excited, I think, and I've said this on my blog and on Twitter, the new association is great because it's going to open a lot of other content possibilities, and I thank them for thinking that much of me. They've been friends for a long time since I've started podcasting, and I respect their show, and I'm very happy to collaborate. But as far as changing the nature editorially or in any way that you hear Word Balloon, don't worry. It's not going to change a thing. As I say, pretty much no difference from the arrangement we had at Newsarama. I'll still, you know, be getting the guests just as I always have. And you'll still enjoy Word Balloon much as you've heard it. Just some other ideas will be coming along the iFanboy and Word Balloon banners. And like I said, I think it opens some opportunities. So thanks, guys, and look forward to our work together in the months and years ahead. Okay, on to business. Today's show, Matt Fraction is here, not only to answer a bunch of questions that we had posted at wordballoon.com and at my message board, but also to talk about some books that have been announced since Matt's conversation with me. Matt and his wife, Kelly Sue DeConnick, are expecting their second child, Tallulah. She might be born by the time you hear this episode. But Matt wanted the opportunity to talk about some books that are coming up, also talk about some ongoings that are already in progress, like Invincible Iron Man and Uncanny X-Men. But his run on Thor is going to begin very soon, and Matt wanted to talk about that. We also talk about Free Comic Book Day and the Iron Man-Thor team-up that'll be in that, with art from Johnny Romita. There's also Matt and Brendan McCarthy's trippy Doctor America, which will be part of the wacky Who Won't Wear the Shield book coming out soon. Matt also takes us through his earliest editorial cues that led to the upcoming Heroic Age. He explains the nature of Iron Man's series of having a science fiction feel. And believe it or not, we'll be talking a lot about the X-Men, not just because Matt writes Uncanny, but we get into some interesting character notes regarding Cyclops, Psylocke, Pixie, and we start to get some of the details of what to expect after Second Coming. All coming up on this episode of Word Balloon. But for now, let's pick up the conversation with Matt Fraction as we take a moment to pay tribute to Dick Giordano. Very sad, the day we're recording this part, Dick Giordano, the news came out that he had passed away.
Yeah, bad. What a sad day all around.
Well, but again, a good life.
One of those sort of Archie Goodwin figures in comics. Right? I've literally never heard an ill word spoken of the man.
Yeah.
Never had a chance to meet him, but man, he and Jim Aparo just. He was the first inker whose work I ever could recognize.
I hear you.
You know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
As a kid, I knew he was the first embellisher, the first inker to be able to deliver a caliber of work that I could look at and see and know right off the bat. Oh, hey, that's Giordano. You know. But sad day.
Yeah, and I mean, for people who don't remember, I mean, he co-founded Continuity with Neil Adams. editor-in-chief of the Charlton Action Heroes in the 60s. And then, of course, you know, beyond his great inking as well on guys like Matt Cetaparo and Neil Adams and the like. Irv Novick, I'm sure, got Dick Giordano treatment on a lot of his Batman stuff as well in the 70s. But, you know, Dick was later in the mid-80s editor-in-chief of DC and presided over those great years of Watchmen, Dark Knight, and, you know, all the stuff that really followed. And I think a lot of the high points of creativity. I think Crisis on Infinite Earths was also part of Dick's tenure. So very cool, man.
Yeah. You know, I always wished that I wished that there would have, I always wanted to, I don't know, maybe it's just somewhere in the archives of Comics Journal, I don't know, but like a Dick Giordano, Danny O'Neill interview about that era at DC. I would love to read, I would love to hear. Just, you know, one of those things where, you know, if you're at a show and you ever see somebody that the whose work you appreciate and you're nervous or you're embarrassed or you don't, you know, you just, I regret that I didn't have a chance to shake the man's hand when I had the opportunity.
And I was never, unfortunately, at any cons that he was at the same time. And I thought about, wanted to do a word balloon with him, but as I understood it, he was hard of hearing, so a phone interview was really out of the question. So, there you go.
Wow. One of the greats.
Absolutely, man. Well, all right, and on that downer note.
Jesus, John.
Have I killed the audience? Is everyone tuned out? Is everyone asleep now? Yeah. All right, fantastic. Yeah. No. I want to ask about a couple of questions regarding some announcements that have been made since we began our taping. And one of them was this Captain America weird little one-shot that's coming out. Why don't you describe it and your feature in it?
Well, it was one of those things where Steve Wacker and I have never had a chance to work together and sort of get along really well and have been looking for something and just said nothing's lined up. He said to me, you know, kind of out of the blue, at a retreat, hey, who won't wield the shield? You want to do a thing? We're just going to make fun of Captain America. I'm like, yeah, great, sure. Let me, when do you need it? He's like, I need it by something. I'm like, yeah, let me see if I come up with an idea. We'll see where we're at. He's like, okay, great. So this is the middle of retreat, and then on the last day of the retreat, he and I end up sitting next to each other so we could hold hands easier and pass notes without distracting the rest of the room. And at one point during a break, he looks at me, and he goes, Brendan McCarthy. And right then and there, Isaac, done. You'll have it tomorrow.
Cool.
That's it. And so he's literally sitting there emailing Brendan trying to make this happen. And Steve did, just by sort of force of will, found the space in Brendan's schedule with his production on Fever, his Spider-Man and Doctor Strange book, it's interesting. I got to write Marvel style.
Okay.
Just hearing McCarthy, and suddenly it just became like I just knew the story fell in my head and everything. I just right away knew what I was going to do and knew what it was going to be like and feel like. Brendan likes working Marvel style, so it's my first. I actually wrote it Marvel style and sort of overwrote it Marvel style somehow, and put as much crazy shit as in there. I put six times more in the script, and then Brendan added his own crazy shit on top of it. So it is a bonkers bonanza, and the story of Dr. Steven Rogers, who has a doctorate in occult literature, and is abducted by the undergovernment to smoke the Super Satan formula and to take the front lines of the freak battles of the 60s. And very much writing a love letter to McCarthy and to the Milligan and McCarthy comics of yore. I love Brendan's stuff so much. I told Steve when I sent it to him, because it's so clearly me trying to do like a Brendan McCarthy comic, that it's like, it's a little bit like sending Paul McCartney your cover version of Michelle. Like,
you're Jeff Lynne.
I was a little, exactly. I was a little,
you're better
I was
than
a little
Jeff Lynne,
to ELO his ass. But no, I Mr. Blue Sky'd all over him. And anyway, he liked it and he laughed. And it's quite possibly the most insane six pages Marvel Comics has ever published.
Cool. Given the characters that are mentioned in the interviews that you've done so far.
Yeah.
The Sinister Red Dick is in there, Richard Milhouse Manson.
Yeah. Richard Milhouse Manson, the Sinister Red Dick. And then, of course, his right-hand man, B.B. Rebeyonder. A band.
Wikipedia,
kids. May or may not be James Brown and the JBs, an event that may or may not be Altamont. A Buckyball, the Goat Boy. I mean, it's this whole ridiculous thing. And I don't know, like Jason Aaron wrote a bookend sequence of that features me and like Brubaker and Jason and Bendis are all in it. And Axel Alonso shows up and some of the Marvel editorial. It's a lot like the old, it feels a lot like, a little bit like what the used to. It's very much sort of a Marvel Comics Mad Magazine kind of thing. So yeah, just the opportunity to work with Brendan was really just a lifelong dream. And yeah, it is berserk. It is fucking bonkers.
And a Golden Age Deadpool
and
story?
I literally can't believe I got paid for it. But I did. The check cashed. They can't take it back. It's done. It's out there. So.
And I guess a Golden Age Deadpool story from Stuart Moore?
Yes. Stuart's got a Golden Age Deadpool. Jason's got a Four Bushman thing. So I think there might still be room for one or two surprises beyond the solicit, too. But I don't want to.
Sure. Very cool.
Crisscross applesauce give any hints that end up not coming to fruition.
Very cool. And then Free Comic Book Day sounds
yeah,
very cool.
Holy shit.
Let's talk Iron Man and Thor.
Yeah, it's an Iron Man Thor thing, and John Romita Jr. is drawing it. So like,
how about that?
3 million people are going to associate my words and Johnny's art, which is kind of amazing. It's a fun, it's like getting in touch with my inner Bill Mantlo, kind of. it's a fun done in one romp. You know, there's a threat that directly involves Tony and Thor, and it deals with both the two of them where they are at this exact moment. So if you're, a super fan and going, going to the shop weekly, it fits right into where Iron Man and Thor both are. And if you're Johnny come lately off the street, you just saw Iron Man or whatever, it makes sense. And God, it is gorgeous. So, it's crazy to get to write that this year.
That's cool. And it sounds, well, in some ways, I mean, I don't know about the tone of the story, but, much like your Iron Man, Spider-Man team up that you had early on in your Iron Man.
It is very much that story. It is very much like that. It is self-contained. It's very fun. It's very light. With enough, underpinnings to what else has been happening for there to be a kind of a larger resonant thing. But yeah, no, it's just, I always think back to, And I certainly mean no disrespect to the creators involved, but, like 100 years ago, there was a issue of TV Guide that had an X-Men comic in it.
Yes.
Right before the X-Men movie came out, and it was completely impenetrable.
Yes, we discussed this before. Go on.
Yeah, so, like, that was the worst case. Like, that was the, don't write that. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, just don't be that dude. Anyway, yeah. So with that is my worst case scenario. Yeah, just don't do that. And there we go. I hope you dig it, because goddamn, it was an awful lot of fun to write. And like I said, the bummer is with the baby coming, I've not made any plans for Free Comic Day, so I don't think I'm going to be anywhere. Yeah, I might like drive. If depending on how the baby is, I might drive around to some of the stores in town. But I've not got anything planned for like the biggest day of my career. I'm like, well, I'll probably be changing diapers and hoping the baby's not colicky. So,
well,
the ultimate tragedy, the ultimate sadness is I'm just going to be here.
Well, sorry, you're making the donuts. That's the important. The fans are happy about that. That's the good news.
These are all first class problems. These are first world, first class, top shelf,
top-notch
problems to have. Believe me, I'm not complaining.
I also wondered, just in
fucking
general...
Fucking babies, John. That's what I'm saying. These motherfucking babies.
Yeah. Father of the year, ladies and gentlemen.
God damn it. Yeah, the other day, Henry came in and crawled into bed. It was bedtime, and he looked at me and he went, Dad, I pooped everything. Moments like that, man, make it all worthwhile.
I was wondering, in general, the heroic age, did it change many of your plans when, this, I mean, it sounds like it was probably mapped out early enough that maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but I'll ask.
Yeah, No. The earliest hints of my first notes for what would become the Heroic Age in sort of a sketch of a notebook from my very first editorial retreat, which would be the retreat where I got Iron Man.
Okay.
The retreat where we decided to, when Ed had told me and Warren that he was going to have to leave Iron Fist. So that was the retreat where we decided to end Iron Fist, the retreat where I got Iron Man. My earliest note for this time of the Marvel publishing line was simply Rise Up. It was like a Rise or Rise Up. I don't remember what I wrote. But sort of coming through Secret Invasion and what became Dark Reign was kind of thumbnailed as the Peter Parker year,
mm-hmm.
where everybody, even when they win, they lose, would have, you know, that kind of year. We knew that we were heading towards the end of this, towards what would become Siege and everything else. And what I got to work with Brian on, which was sort of, which became, you know, X-Men Dark Avengers to the list to Siege, kind of forming this, you know. It's really a crossover in 20 parts, even though it only looks like a crossover in a few parts, kind of story. This was always planned. Like, we knew that once we came through what became Siege, it would be time for the good guys to start winning again, and everybody would be tired of the bad guys stuff. So it's sort of, it's fitting right there, and I knew that I'd be through Disassembled by this point. And like, hey, that's right around the time Iron Man 2 would be coming out. So it'd be a perfect time for a new armor and a new look and a new jumping on point, you know? And at that point, I didn't know that I'd be writing Thor, but in terms of both X-Men and Iron Man, this time of year, really since before Secret Invasion, I think everyone knew, at least peripherally, this is where shit's going to get good again.
The listeners have come out in force, and I think we've got about 50 questions to get through.
Right.
I know. So without further ado, it's great to welcome Matt Fraction back to another Fireside Chat. I think that's going to be our phrase now, Matt. It seemed to work
so well
last time.
We'll have Fireside Chat. I could light a fire, I suppose.
No, I wouldn't ask you to do that. That's all right. You know, it worked for FDR back in the 30s, but it's not necessary for us. Everyone can imagine the snaps and the crackles. That'll probably be on the feed. But
exactly. Well, maybe we can just go through. We can sweeten it and drop in a little Foley.
I'll crumple cellophane while we're talking. I think that'll achieve the effect. Let's go on. We've got Panco. Back when I was a design student, we loved every video that MK12 used to put out. I believe you helped founding that studio. What drove you away from high profile design works and made you make the move to comics? That's the origin question.
Boy, that's a really Ultimately, I didn't want to work in advertising anymore, and I wasn't willing, with a family, with a son, I wasn't willing to put the hours in that everyone else there was expected to put in. And as one of the founders of the shop, it didn't feel fair, and I knew in my heart of hearts, ultimately, it wasn't what I wanted to do the rest of my life anyway.
Okay.
So that's the simple version, I guess. I miss shooting very much. I still, you know, miss design and miss those conversations and miss that world, but the day-to-day drudgery of working in advertising, I don't miss. I don't miss clients, and I don't miss ad agencies, and I don't miss the abuse, and I don't miss, you know, I don't miss everything that's shitty about that life. But, you know, because ultimately it wasn't what I wanted to do, so.
There's so much more equipment now available at a much more reasonable price, and even better equipment than, you know, 10 years ago when you were still working over there. Do you have stuff at home that if you ever want to make full-on video or anything like that, you know?
No, I could probably shoot and cut something. My machine actually, I could.
Well, it's clearly not in the front of your mind, so.
Kind of the thing about, but I mean, you know, it comes and goes every now and then. You know, Ed Baker put a short together, and it's terrific, and things like that make me miss shooting. I miss that stuff an awful lot. But it's such a huge time commitment, and it's tough with a kid.
Sure.
To be able to put that kind of stuff together. You know, I never say never. Like, I really miss shooting, and I'm still in touch with a few friends. And every now and again, someone will float a job my way or whatever. And, you know, Wieden Kennedy, my favorite ad agency, actually the only ad agency that I genuinely could have ever imagined myself working for, they're in Portland. So, you know, there's still, you know, the contacts are still there. The opportunity is still there if I ever got the itch. Too bad, I suppose. But never say never. It's tough. I miss shooting a lot. So I would be surprised if I never got behind a camera again.
Ron Fire, 99, a newcomer. Guys, excited for the conversation as always. Usually makes for great listening. Wait.
Usually.
Invincible.
There was that time where we did nothing but talk about Chicago DJs of the 70s and 80s for 4.5 hours. That made for really shitty listening, but...
No, I don't know. I was entertained. Invincible Iron Man is a very of-the-moment, cultural, specifically American in the early 21st century feel to it. Is that a conscious, authorial decision? Does Stark, as a real-world businessman, lend himself to that mood, or is that just how it all filters out onto the page?
Yeah, no, it's everything is very conscious. Without trying to pin it too specifically to real world, real chronology, you know, kind of situations. Stark is a character that's kind of uniquely capable of commenting on the world as it happens around us, specifically the kind of geopolitical stuff of it all. You know what I mean? Like, he's the character where you can, because of the nature of the world, because of the nature of his origins and who he was, you can kind of talk about this stuff with him in a way that would feel maybe shoehorned in if Spider-Man was dealing with Al-Qaeda. You know what I mean?
Sure. No, understandably. Yeah, you're right, especially as a weapons dealer as well.
Yeah, and you know, if you get specific, exactly, but, you know, if you can't quite get specific... Chronologically, the minute you identify 9/11, it's been 9 years, and you start doing math in your head as to how old Iron Man is. And wait, did he get blown up in Vietnam? And shouldn't he be 64 by now?
Right.
You know, all this kind of.
Well, Warren put extremists in like the first Iraq War?
Yeah, it was like Afghanistan.
Okay, there you go. Yeah,
it was time shifted into the Middle East, and you know, even so, it's one of those things where. You can be, what's the word, relevant and timely without getting terribly specific. And yeah, that's very much a conscious choice. To me, it should be a science fiction book, but a science fiction book that, like Max Headroom, you know, takes place 20 minutes into the future. That whole first arc, you know, like we had the weird, you know, the shtick with kids with backpacks blowing up cities with, you know, repulsor bombs or whatever.
Yes.
The series of that first storyline had just wrapped up when Mumbai happened, and suddenly there were kids with backpacks blowing up cities in Mumbai. So it's one of those kind of like that's crappy and spooky, but you know, there's that sort of nightmare stuff that came out of just kind of doing reading and hypothesizing about horrible things for the comic, and then the real world catches up with your horrible thinking, and there you are.
Will you still be playing with the covers the way Salvador and Ryan Hughes have been doing?
Yeah, there's a look set for Stark Resilience starting with 25. I'm not sure what we're doing beyond that. I hope so. Because I've heard nothing but good things about it, and I like how it looks. I ultimately, it's not my day to run the company, so if somebody decides, no, we want to go back looking how it did, then we'd have to be where we were. But yeah, you know, Ryan's going to win an Eisner this year, so we'll have that going. I'm convinced that those covers are gonna win awards. They're so beautiful. They're going to at least win the Maddies. He's going to sweep the Maddies for best comic I was involved with all year covers. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We've got to look for 25. We'll see where we go beyond that.
I understand. And it was tough to choose because I love the new design. I agree with you. I think it looks very striking, and it does stand out on the newsstand. By the same token, there were a lot of iconic covers that were offered as an alternative as well.
One wasn't particularly more rare than the other. And Pat Zerker did a great job with the other ones, no doubt. So yeah, it was fun to do. You know, locally, just my own anecdotal evidence and talking to shops around here and at shows I've done is that the Ryan Hughes ones have been the ones that sell out first, and boy, they stand out a mile away. So yeah, we'll see. Hopefully we can keep it up. But if not, listen, having covers that, you know, looked like this past Zurich covers weren't particularly. I wasn't a bummer by anybody's imagination either. So,
Ron has another question. It's a craft question. When telling a story, what are your priorities above all else? What do you want to come through the clearest of all the narrative elements of a story?
I don't know that that's a fixed. I think that depends on the story. You know, I always try to ask myself, you know, what happens and what's it about, you know?
Sure.
The answer is different every time. Every issue, every scene, you know? Sometimes, every panel. If I'm doing my job well, anyway.
Jimmy F., 1982. Guys, thanks for doing another sit-down. Always look forward to them. Matt, have you had any story ideas for your Marvel work shot down because they were too out there, a la your Casanova work or your own other properties?
No, actually.
Is Axel your godfather over there? I mean, who, you know, I mean, I know, or is it Brevoort now? I mean, like who?
I suppose Axel. I mean, I'm sort of now spread out to a bunch of different offices. So,
okay.
But no, I mean, I really feel like my first year at Marvel, my most formative time at Marvel was really Axel and Warren Simons, who mm-hmm. was his assistant, and then went off moved over into Tom's office and for a while was basically editing me on everything. But yeah, Axel and Warren, you know, Axel's tutelage was really what kind of got me, you know, helped cut my teeth that first year. No, I don't know. In fact, you know, Joe and Axel and you know, the guys at Marvel, they're fans of Casanova, hence it being at Icon. You know, they like it. You know, Dan Buckley likes it, which is kind of weird and terrifying to say, but it's true. So yeah, I don't know if I'm not being aggressive enough or. Nothing gets really shot down out of hand. You know, any idea can have its day in the sun. I've told the story before, but you know, when Axel first came to me about writing Punisher War Journal, I thought about it for a couple of days and called him back with the idea of killing Frank Castle, and introducing a new Punisher, And I had written, at that point, one 11-page short story for Marvel, and a graphic novel he was fond of. You know what I mean? Like, Five Fists hadn't come out. I don't know if he had seen the IDW stuff or not. Like, I had very little stuff to my name.
Okay.
But he liked Independence, and I had worked kind of pitching his office for a while. And you know, like, it's day three of our relationship, I suggested killing Frank Castle. And he didn't laugh it off or shut me up. We discussed it for about a week and workshopped the idea and played it through both of us until we realized that ultimately the story didn't work. But the idea itself wasn't rejected at all. It was seriously explored and talked about. And that was, I think, when I knew that I was going to do okay. You know what I mean? Like, that was a big thing. Like,
sure.
I felt like, well, if we're not going to be able to have this discussion, I'm not going to work. I'm not going to fit in. You know, I was kind of aware when I brought it up, like this could be like terminating the relationship. Like this could be, you know, bringing up 10 minutes into the blind date that, you know, hey, I've got three kids. Is that a problem? Like I knew that could be the boner killer for the night, but it was great. And it was exciting to be able to discuss it with Axel and to workshop the idea and kind of game it out for a while and play it through to its logical conclusion. So no, my time at Marvel has been really terrific. I'm trying to think of something. I can't think of any specific examples, but no, we suggested moving the X-Men to San Francisco, and everybody was into it. You know what I mean?
Well, that's fine. That's familiar territory. A little less drastic than the killing the Punisher. I think that proves it as well. Can you tell us how much input you've had on the new Pepper miniseries? Any teases for it?
It's just a one-shot, unless we're talking about something different. None. They were looking at bringing in more female writers as part of this initiative that is taking place during Women's History Month and kind of taking the year to celebrate the women of Marvel. And I was talking to Alejandro Arbona, my editor or assistant editor, I'm not sure what his title is these days, on Iron Man and Thor, and suggested my wife, and he knew Kelly Sue and thought it was a great idea, and Ralph Macchio, Alejandro's immediate superior, didn't know that Kel was my wife.
Huh.
So with Kel's permission, when Kel being in, she just blind submitted herself. Sent 30 days to Ralph and Alejandro, and Ralph read it, thought, like, yeah, great, give her a shot. And then we said, hey, Ralph, guess what? So that was it. We didn't want her, we wanted to we wanted to give her avoid any. It's impossible to avoid the appearance of nepotism just because I am who I am and we're married. But at least we wanted to play it clean like that. My only input was she had this story she wanted to tell. She wanted to talk about a thing, and I answered a question of chronology. Like, that was my, like, I had to, explain basically what happened between Iron Man 19 and 20 for Pepper. Like, that was my input. Like, what happened? How did she get from here to there?
Okay.
And that was my answer. Well, she was here and hung out. Okay, great. And that was all. That was it. And the rest is all her.
Is she on full-time mommy duty, or is she able to make a quick cameo and talk about maybe Pepper and Sith?
She's in bed with a little man.
Okay, man.
But I would not be tough to get her on the phone. If you want, I will. We can set that up. That would be terrific.
Absolutely. No, I've asked her before, and I know she's doing Sith too, right?
Yeah. And actually, she just printed out that's being lettered as we speak, because she just printed it out downstairs on my printer before she went to bed.
Oh, cool.
And God damn, this looks amazing.
Who's drawing that for?
I believe this is Andrea Moody, and it looks like a cross between Humberto Ramos. It's got like it's a little Humberto Ramos. It's a little Art Adams.
Wow!
It's gorgeous, and I felt like it's not my business to be flipping through this, but these pages kept spinning out of my printer, and I was like, God damn, this is really good. There is a couple of superstars in the making, if you don't mind my saying, looking at my wife's first Marvel comic.
Very cool.
It's sure shit better than my first Marvel comic, so I couldn't be more proud, and goddamn, it looks amazing.
I see a lot of role-playing at the dinner table as Thor and Sith. let's leave it there. I don't want to creep anybody out. But yeah, exactly.
True. No. But no, she had the core of the story. She had the kernel of an idea that she wanted to do. And I just kind of answered a continuity question: what happens between 19 and 20 timeline? When do people show up in Broxton? That was basically my question. What I was asked. And she produced this really terrific piece of work. It was the kind of story that because it's Tony Stark's book and not Pepper's book.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to tell. You know what I mean? But it's terrific, and I really hope. I was thinking about this today. I really hope they collect it along with the Stark Disassembled trade.
Cool.
I don't know if they will or not. But it fits very well, and I couldn't be more proud of it. It's a terrific piece of work.
Very neat. And Jimmy says, thanks again, gentlemen. We are truly players. Okay. Yes, of course we are. Big ups to you, Jimmy. Thank you.
Word to all your mother.
Yes.
Jimmy, word to your mother. Word to all of our mothers.
Yes, I'm pouring a 40 on the curb in honor of you. Thank you, Jimmy.
I've emptied a bag of Mrs. Paul's fish sticks onto the curbside for all of our mothers.
Dr. Catclops, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, Matt and John.
Ooh, he's not just a doctor. I actually have a good authority that Dr. Catclops is also a lawyer, like one of those guys on the back of the phone books.
Oh, man, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. No, you're getting too many fees, doctor. That's not right. If Tony Stark is an atheist, why did he give Thor power of attorney? Is a good kind of ecclesial question. Father.
He might not believe in God, but he sure as shit believes in lawyers.
There you go. Well,
makes sense.
A little bit. I understand. Well, no, I've
the law, you know.
It wasn't like, yeah, Your Honor, I called Dr. I called the mighty Thor to the stand. He was calling, you know, yeah. Dr. Blake is there to answer those questions.
Yeah, no. It was a legal decision, not a spiritual one.
I understand.
Although we got into that a little bit in Disassembled. I like the idea of Thor being Tony's higher power. it makes his life so much more fucked up, you know.
I liked everyone who showed up in that story. You know, I mean, it's and of course, I'm always happy to see Stephen Strange, and I like the slightly depowered Stephen Strange.
Yeah, a little depowered, and Kung Fu Doctor Strange, like the Ditko finger Kung Fu.
Yes, master of the mystic arts and the Kung Fu arts.
Listen,
yes.
Listen. As far as I'm concerned, that is my one panel Doctor Strange pitch. Ditko finger Kung Fu. Who doesn't want to fucking read that book? He walks around, he gets involved in, you know, mystic what's it, he tweaks his fingers and kicks ass like Bruce Lee, but Bruce Lee with, you know, salt and pepper sideburns and a turtleneck. Great. Anyway, that was a bust. That Tony's monologue that opened the issue 19, you know, where he's just like that eight pages where he's just talking to camera, those were the first comic pages I wrote in Portland once I had moved here.
Oh, interesting.
Once I got to town with all my shit, with the dogs and everything, I was here. I think that was my second or third day in town. I went to a diner and on Hawthorne and sat and had breakfast and wrote it all longhand in my notebook. And that was like my those were the first pages that I wrote here in Portland, was that speech. And when I read it, that's all I can think, and all I see, and all I hear, and all I read is all of the fucking anxiety that came with moving your family halfway across country in 6 weeks or 9 weeks, like we did.
That's cool. I also enjoyed reading yours and Bendis's conversation in the Comic-Con magazine about process.
That's exactly how we speak to each other all the time. That is exactly. that's how we talk to each other casually all the time.
Why? Yes, it's true.
Now tell me about your work. Now that was a lot of fun to do. And Brian, it's interesting. He's been teaching a class out here.
I know. I look forward to talking to him about it. I didn't want to bother him while it was going on because I figured he was heavily into it and running around too.
It clearly was like a pilgrimage for him into his own craft. Like he's so on fire. It's really cool. Like he clearly got as much out of that class as some of his students did. It's like inflamed him. He's like gone back to the source and come out like just. It's really a blast to talk to him about that shit these days because he's clearly on fire with it right now.
And you guest lectured, didn't you, for him?
Yeah. I went down there for a day and you know, had a crazy lesson plan. Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
What'd you talk about?
The difference between writing hard and writing smart. One of the big things I needed to learn and still need to learn is what is part of this was me being, you know, coming from an art background and coming from a directorial, like a live action and animation background, but learning what was my realm to write and what wasn't, you know,
leaving it for the artist.
Reading. Yeah. And like you have this, you know, no one reads your scripts, but you, your artist and your editor, maybe your colorist. Maybe the letterer, you know?
Sure.
But that's it. Other than that, so you're really writing for an audience of four in a lot of ways. And I always felt, you know, you always hear stories about Alan Moore and like,
right.
Oh, there'd be three panels of page descriptions and all that stuff. That's amazing if you're Alan Moore, because Alan Moore is a one-of-a-kind, one-in-a-million autodidactic iconoclast. And if I try to write like that, it's bullshit. And it's smothering and it's making more work for me, and it actually gets in the way of writing. So I started off by reading the first panel description from the first page of the first chapter of From Hell, which is a 3.5 page description of two guys walking down a beach, contrasted with the script of the first panel of the first page of Garth Ennis's last Punisher miniseries, which was the same shot of two guys walking down a beach. Garth's was a sentence long. Alan's was 3.5 pages. You know what I mean? And so we just kind of talked about what I want to, you know, about, like, if your sentence, if your panel description is a sentence long, as long as it's the right sentence, that's good writing. That's great writing, and you should be happy. But, you know, it was very much once you've decided what your page, what your breakout's going to be, and how your flow goes, and what your when you know it's time to script, write smart. Don't necessarily write hard because you're just getting in your own way. And, you know, Eddie Campbell did all this great stuff about working on From Hell, and he'd show like a block of text for it'd be a panel in an issue from like one of the Alec graphic novels. Mm-hmm. It'd just be a panel of solid words. You know, it's night falls and the fog presses its back against the damp cobblestones of, you know, and then you see the panel as it appeared in From Hell, and it's great. There's night and there's fog, and then you would see what he had done to the script, which was cross out every word but like night, fog, cobblestone. You know, like that's what the artist is looking for. The rest is sort of, you're writing for you to just not. You know, I wanted to sort of talk about economy and brevity and mm-hmm. writing smart, writing with a minimalist eye. And then it ended with I took a page from Batman Year One, had the original script for, and put the final page up on the overhead projector and had the class reverse engineer a script out of that, looking at the finished art. And then it was like, all right, so write this script. What did the script look like? How did Frank Miller put this on a page to give it to Dave Mazzucchelli? What did Dave Mazzucchelli read to create this? And that was the exercise, was write the right sentences to get this thing on the page.
Convey the idea. Interesting, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, it was a lot of fun.
Very cool.
And I was very nervous and very, very uptight. Very, very uptight. Very, very undued. I was very, very undued about it.
New Chad. Who do you see as being, yes, as opposed to old Chad? This is new and improved Chad from London. Who do you see as being the hero on Uncanny X-Men? Is it Scott Summers? Because he's been acting like a bit of a dick.
There's not one hero. Everybody is the hero in their own mind. Respectfully disagree with the premise that there is any given hero. Has Scott been acting like a bit of a dick? I mean, he's a leader. He's trying to keep less than 200 people alive, you know, in a world that is turning in and trying to kill them all at once. So perhaps he's been a little less laughy and chuckly lately, but, you know, he's a general and he's in a war. For me, the fun of Scott is he's really a beta dog, you know, but he's in the role of an alpha. He's got to act like an alpha, but deep down inside, he's a beta. And that's kind of the root of his conflict. Hopefully this is his crucible, and coming through Nation X and now the return of Kitty and right after that the return of Hope is the ultimate test of his faith. And stay tuned, he's got a big year ahead.
When you took over on Uncanny, it seemed as though Pixie was going to become the point of view character in the book. Do you think that role is being filled by any other characters at the moment?
I wanted her to be, you know, I feel like every generation has, like, well, you know, there was Kitty Pryde. One of those. It is still very much intended to be Pixie. Now, she has kind of rotated away from the center of the stage. But again, it's a massive ensemble book that kind of eschews who the teams are. She'll be coming back, rotating back into the main group of stories moving forward into the new year. Pixies are Babe in the Woods. She's got a big role in Second Coming. She's awful important there. We get to see her kind of, cowboy up a little bit in Second Coming, which is a lot of fun. She gets she has a moment of intense responsibility, which is a lot of fun to see, considering where she started, you know?
And she's in good hands.
Our little dreamboat on the Vespa has come so far.
And she's in good hands, too, with Catherine on the miniseries, right?
Oh, it's so great. Oh, my God. It's so, so great.
Yeah, I hope to talk to Catherine and Stuart's very soon and talk about that and moving pictures as well and the other stuff Catherine's got coming up for Marvel. So,
yeah,
very cool.
Well, please let them know that no one in comics likes them. They are
ostracized.
They are wildly untalented, and none of us want anything to do with them. They are not fabulous. They are not stylish. They are not enviable in any sense. And in fact, they do not make us feel inferior in any way. No, no.
I hope they're coming to Chicago.
They are comics' own charity case.
Exactly, but we all tolerate them nonetheless. They're
exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Alan,
we suspect they are actually God's spies, and if we are cruel to them, it will reflect poorly on us in the afterlife.
Alan from Canada. Hi, John and Matt. I've always enjoyed these interviews in particular. And for Matt, Iron Man is consistent with each issue. In fact, I should go back and point out that New Chad said that Invincible Iron Man is the best book on the shelves.
Hey, thank you, New Chad.
So that's very cool. And Alan is saying good things as well. And he's catching up on X-Men and Trades. He loves your portrayal of Scott because it's about time he acted like the leader that he was meant to be, despite your beta claims to the contrary.
You know what I mean?
I do.
He's never going to believe he's accomplished what he's accomplished. He's never going to let himself enjoy it. I don't know. That's the deliciousness of the perpetual nervous breakdown that is Scott Summers.
And it comes through. You're right. I think in his early years, he relied on the professor. Currently, he's relying on Emma. You know, I mean, I think you see it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Emma has a line in 522 where... Magneto goes catatonic because he's kind of trying to bring Kitty home. And there's a moment where Emma is left on top of Mount Tam with Magneto, and she's kind of just talking to keep herself company.
Okay.
Because she can't even get into his thoughts. She's talking about why he feels kind of so hostile towards Magneto. It's because everything that Scott has to work and fight and struggle to do is effortless to Magneto. Like, he's charming. He's inspiring. People follow him. People believe what he says when he says it. You know, all the shit that drives Scott up the fucking wall just comes to Magneto like it's, it's his natural gift. So there's that sort of, Scott is just lacking that he's lacking whatever innate quality makes an alpha dog an alpha dog. Scott don't have it.
Here's his questions, one regarding craft and the other on comics. Let's start with the craft question. I'm in the middle of assembling a script for a comic I'll be working on in the future. So far, I've established the beginning and what the ideal end would be in terms of plotting. However, I've had trouble in terms of how much content should go in an issue. This is rather vague, but as a writer, how do you know when to begin and end an issue or a chapter in terms of pacing? Any suggestions you can give would be great.
My process is all sort of born from making lists. You know, the way I write starts with lists becoming longer, becoming outlines, becoming scripts, you know. And a big part of that is being able to grow and contract those lists and shuffle them around. I also need something kind of physical to do. So there's a kind of I've started to write scene ideas and rough outlines once they kind of take shape in a notebook on index cards, just so I can have something to move around with my hands and I can build and reorder and restructure and reshuffle. And you just kind of feel it out. You feel your instinct, like, oh, this feels about right. It's like, start with your structure and kind of, there's your beginning, there's your end, there's your middle, there's this stuff, there's that stuff, there's this twist, there's this scene, I want this line, you know, guess. On index cards, and then shuffle around, add to it, take away, and sometimes I'll jot down how many pages a scene feels like, you know, and then that kind of expands and contracts and grows and shifts and moves, and you'll get into the writing of it, and stuff will occur to you like, oh shit, I needed this or I need that, you know. So there's no answer. There's no right answer. You just, I think, have to commit and prepare to be wrong and change your game plan. You know, I believe very much in over preparing and completely improvising. And I think you can completely improvise only if you've over prepared. I think that's it. You just kind of got to go on your instinct and try it and sketch around and figure out how long your scenes are and see where that leaves you. And make sure there's a good reason for somebody to flip every page and a good reason to come back next issue.
And I'm curious, Stark Disassembled was five issues. I can't help but notice Siege only being 4 issues. Is there any type of, you know, editorial edict to step away from the 6-part arcs and do shorter arcs now? From a
No. At least not that I've heard.
Okay.
It all kind of, you know, start to, you know, World's Most Wanted started off as 5 or 6 and became a year once I started writing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or started to outline it, really. The first Thor arc is 6, I believe.
Okay.
13, 14, 16, yeah, 6. But then Stark Resilient is 8. So, like, it all kind of, you know, it all ebbs and flows and grows and contracts as is needed.
Interesting. Okay, and yeah, I absolutely want a moment, depending on where questions go, we'll be talking more about Thor. And as we're recording, the events of Siege 3 have played out this week, so
yes.
That clearly has to impact Thor's world and where things will be going. Alan Ur also asks an X-Men question, and it kind of ties in again to Scott being a beta. He's always enjoyed your take on Cyclops and enjoys how he's a take-no-prisoners kind of leader. My problem always was that he was always a step away from being so confident, depending on who wrote him. In your process, what ideas have helped you to decide to give him a stronger leadership role? So build on what we've been talking about so far, if there is more to say.
Well, the events, you know, it's the idea that he's, and I really think Axel was articulating this as I came in, as he was kind of, you know, preparing me for where he was going to be. You know, we started talking about me coming in and co-writing originally right before Messiah Complex, right after the Messiah Complex, like, summit had happened. You know, the notion that Scott has really been a general preparing for one war his entire life, and now it's being fought. And that's it. Like, this is what he's been training for. This was the worst-case scenario that Xavier always knew was a possibility, and knew that Scott was the guy that he needed, a beta who would never, you know... The reason why it's not Magneto is because Magneto can get corrupted, you know, mm-hmm. and Scott's self-doubt will ultimately always be what keeps him from being corrupted by power. Scott will never, ever, ever believe he deserves to have it. And that's it. Just that sort of germ of humbleness and humanity, to the point of deprecation, will keep Scott... rooted, that little hint of insecurity will keep him rooted to his humanity. And this is it. This is the war he's been raised to fight his entire life. You know, he is John Connor, and this is his Terminator.
Judgment
Terminators
Day.
Terminators 2 through 4.
Pidge from Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Matt and John, I really enjoy these interviews. Matt, I've been loving your work on Uncanny and Invincible Iron Man. I'm also really looking forward to your take on Thor. Those one-shots you did were great.
Thank you.
I was wondering.
Not a question. I love it.
Yeah, there you go. I was wondering if you have any plans for a more definitive, structured X-Men team after Second Coming. And if not, do you have any plans to spotlight some other X-Men characters, like Nightcrawler, fingers crossed, that is, if he makes it out of Second Coming alive, or Iceman. I really like to see your take on those two particular characters. Thanks for the great stories. Looking forward to 2010.
All right. Oh,
even though we're halfway there.
That is awesome. Yes and no. We're going to see specific clusters of characters dealing with specific storylines. You know, it's going to continue to be kind of an ensemble piece, but focusing on, you know, a smaller group of different characters, and I still want the freedom to be able to rotate people in and out as I see as the stories require. Nightcrawler's got some huge stuff coming up in Second Coming, and with Hank McCoy being gone from the team, it was that there's a scene with Bobby and Hank a couple issues back where Bobby was like destroying the Predator X bodies. And Hank was kind of having his nervous breakdown. In the writing of that scene, I finally understood who Iceman is beyond just being a fan. You know what I mean? Like, there's one thing to kind of be a fan of a character. There's another thing to be a writer of the character.
Certainly, yeah. Finding his voice, absolutely.
Yeah, but like his whatever
reason for being. Yeah.
How do you say I don't know what? You know, his soul, his spirit.
Sure.
So I always knew who the guy was, and like as a fan, and I always, but as a writer, I could never find the place for him that made sense. But now I've got it and it's figured out. So Iceman has some cool stuff coming up in the next year as well.
Very cool. D. George. Hey, guys, first of all, thank you, John, for the consistently great interviews and discussions. Thank you, D. George.
That's true, John, and I would like to thank you for that as well.
You're very nice.
Word Balloon is first among equals. You are the in a field of really strong podcasting. You know, there's a group of you guys that really know what you're doing and really do it well. So Word Balloon is unmissable and never less than incredibly listenable.
That's awesome.
And I love it. Thank you so much for your work, John.
You're a good man.
Really, I really love doing this.
You know, it means a lot, Matt, and I appreciate that and the rest of the community as well that continues to support the show. The fifth anniversary is coming up and
right on.
Yeah, and I couldn't have done it without you guys, so I appreciate your
that
continued
is fantastic.
Support. Absolutely.
I'm not gonna be satisfied until you start showing up at conventions wearing red satin smoking jackets, but you know, we'll get there.
We should seriously, absolutely, the next time we do a convention, I think we need a live Word Balloon after dark, and I will totally do the Hef thing. That would be awesome.
Set up the chairs like a fake fireplace. That would be fantastic.
Oh, look, folks, here's Barbie Benton that has joined the conversation with us. This is great. Fantastic. And Don Adams.
Hi.
Don Adams is doing some shtick for us in the corner over there. Have you seen those? Those are awesome.
Don Adams.
It's. Have you watched those old Playboy After Darks?
No, I've never. I've got my bullet in my my gun for the discussion is the Orson Welles talk show.
Attaboy. Oh.
Which I know we'll get to, but
we will.
But no. So you we'll swing back around to great moments in talk show catastrophes here in a bit.
When they weren't showing. Whatever, you know, titty movie of the moment on the Playboy Channel. I know years ago, when I used to buy the Playboy Channel more regularly, they used to show old episodes of Playboy After Dark, and it would either be Don Adams or Dick Gregory or Dick Shawn. All the dicks were represented, apparently.
Exactly. All the dicks.
All the comedy dicks. And, it was always great stuff. And, oh, yeah, fantastic. Oh, here's Don Adams to say something. Very fun.
Oh, my God.
And on that consistent note, D. George wants to know what it was like to be a guest on Tom Sharpling's Best Show on WFMU.
Oh, dude, it was spooky. It was terrifying. It's not every day you get to ruin your favorite radio show.
Is that what happened? I didn't hear your appearance. You're gonna have to tell me about it.
No. I think it went okay. But
good.
I was worried. Like, oh God, just don't try to be funny. Like, don't fuck it up. Don't try to out joke. You know, just go and have fun, and yeah, I was terrified I was going to embarrass myself, you know, and create a shitty episode of my favorite radio show. So, you know, it was a blast though, and Tom was a delight, and Mike was great, and it was great. It was a really fantastic experience, and you know, I got to talk to Bryce. It all happened. It was all fantastic.
What radio and internet included non-podcast media shows are out there, Matt, that you've appeared on? And I know also, not related to this, you've done your video appearance on the MLB Network, of course, but...
Yeah. You know, it was weird. I've only kind of just recently, like, with the video game stuff, I did a little interview on X-Play last year at Comic-Con.
Cool. Have you been on the Sirius XM Howard 100 show that Brian did?
I have not.
Have you heard that show?
But I would love to do it just to get them to do, like, to have my own VO like they've got Brian. Like, that's Brian Bendis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they get the big voice guy, absolutely.
870-time Eisner Award-winning author.
creator, innovator, celebrator. No, it was, I'd love to do that stuff.
That was pretty funny.
Awesome.
And what the fuck, man? That show's on the most irregular schedule. It's like, yeah, we'll be back in 6.5 weeks. You know, it's like, just consult your horoscope to find out our next time of being on. I'm like, what the fuck is going on, man?
Yeah, I only know when Brian mentions it. I don't have Sirius, so I have to kind of...
Now, that's interesting. I would kind of figure you, although I know you love enough podcasts that you don't need Sirius, probably.
Yeah, you know,
That's how I feel about Sirius, and I love audio, and I love good audio, and there's plenty on both Sirius and XM. I just don't, you know, I don't see the need for it, again, because there's so many free podcasts and internet radio and, you know, things that are available that it's like, I'm fine.
Yeah, there's first off that just to sort of, and it's hard to, I mean, I listen to Howard when I hear there are particularly wonderful moments on Howard to listen. I'm not a huge fan, you know, just because I never lived in a market that had it.
Okay.
You know, Howard came to Charlotte about 3 months before I left, so I got to listen to a little Howard in my youth, but
I was going to say, when you were in Chicago, you were too young to hear it when he was on in Chicago, I'm guessing, maybe.
When was he on in Chicago?
Well, it was like the early to mid 90s. I mean, you know, I don't know how.
Yeah, no, I was gone by that point. I remember the old WOR TV show.
Yes.
That I saw in Iowa. So I remember him doing Petey Green impressions. Like, I remember, like blackface guy, like, and I remember him doing, like, Bongo Fiesta.
Yep, sure.
And stuff like that, and like this crazy TV show that would come on. I don't remember for like what time, like against Saturday Night Live or after Saturday Night Live. Like I saw some of it peripherally, and it was just like, I don't even know what the fuck this is.
Okay.
But yeah, I wasn't until that was my first awareness of Howard Stern was that early WOR TV stuff that he would do.
I got you.
But it was entirely lacking context. You know, it was just, here's the thing that's on at 1 in the morning. So, yeah, it wasn't until, like, 95 that I ever heard, actually get to hear him on the radio.
Okay.
And I loved it. It was great. But it was just, I was gone. And then I was, you know, it was just never around. But, yeah, you know, we're as we're about to welcome our second child, and we're getting a minivan. And the minivan has the Sirius in it.
Sure.
So I will be discovering Sirius here for the first time, and then in the coming, maybe it'll be one of those things that I'll be like, gosh, I don't know how I ever
lived without it.
It's certainly not an itch that I realize needs scratching. So we'll see.
Okay. And wow, here's a blast.
I don't know how Brian does it. Like, I don't have the 8.5 fucking hours a day to listen to it. You know what I mean? Like,
I do.
It's a good day when I can get Daily Show and Colbert both watched.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
Too funny. All right, here's one. I'm a big fan of the Basement Tapes column you did with at CBR with Joe Casey. How did that come about?
Those were sort of kind of the emails that Joe and I did anyway. in a lot of ways, that was sort of, I was kind of just getting started, and Joe, I think, wanted to make some waves.
Yeah, vent.
Be the angry young man that he was at the time, and we were both friendly with Jonah. It was just kind of the right thing at the right time, and it ultimately stopped when, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I'd done a column, a really ill-advised column before that. The premise was, oh, this is going to be my work diary of, like, my year, like, the first year I spent trying to break into comics. Which is a great idea for a column then. It was a great idea. And it was then predicated by every single conversation I had with anybody in comics, any editor at any company. Every conversation I had then began with, don't put this on the internet. So I couldn't actually talk about what I had sold the column to Jonah as being. But, like, I was getting paid for it, so I had to send in something.
Okay.
Like, so yeah, it was kind of a continuation of that in a way, just wanting to kind of do armchair analysis. I don't know how successful it was. I mean, it was fun to do at the time, but I suspect it was, who the fuck is this guy, and what did he do to deserve this soapbox, you know?
Well, that's interesting, because honestly...
I'm definitely my own harshest critic and all this stuff. I appreciate that the guy read it and enjoyed it. I always enjoyed whatever it was Joe wanted to talk about or was talking about. Like just Joe is never less than hilarious.
Absolutely.
Regardless of what he's talking about.
You know, and I'm trying to remember, was that before or after Last of the Independents?
That would have been after.
Okay, so maybe I was aware, because I was going to say, I certainly read it with no feeling of who is this guy, and it helped.
I had a little stuff going on, but I was still, like, primarily my job was working in MK-12, you know, and
uh-huh.
I was still kind of pitching around and doing little bits here and there, but it was, it was always kind of an awkward fit, like, both of you, I was trying to get into the system, and Joe was a part of the system, and there was a degree to which our hands were always tied because my lack of experience or just professional decorum, we couldn't really. I don't know. It was a fun experiment, that's for sure. I don't know that we ever really defined who we were or what we were doing exactly. And by the time I got Punisher, I just couldn't continue because I had to sign 10 billion NDAs just to get in the door because so much of War Journal, they had to explain what Civil War was because Spider-Man was in it, a lot of what, you know, One More Day was going to be.
Okay.
And that was untrue to the spirit of the column. You know, so it was like, and Joe, I think Joe was done anyway. Joe kind of wanted to go in and do other stuff, and it's a grind, so, you know. The salad days. Callow youth. How I miss you.
X-Tor Punk, I guess is how you should say this name, from Nashville. Another newbie. Matt and John, I love your marathon interviews. I can't wait to ignore any other responsibilities and listen to it. You're a good man, X. I have two silly questions.
It's terrifying because that guy's an EMT. It's fucking terrifying.
Here's two silly questions on one topic. With Hercules dead, will Thor grow his beard back? There's a serious lack of bearded Avengers, and if so, will it be the typical blonde person, creepy flesh-colored beard? I think you're thinking of albino, sir.
It would be the red beard. It would definitely be a red. I have that insane Nordic thing in my family where they're blondes with red beards.
Sure.
Which as a kid I never realized was weird until I got older. And Henry's toe-headed. He's darkening up a little, but I wonder if Henry would have a red beard as well. But I kind of think, too, if anything else, just because I think the dude in the movie might have a beard. I wonder if Thor should grow his beard back. I don't know. We'll see.
God, I really hope in 15 years we are still doing something like this, and we can look back and laugh, and when Henry's beard comes out, I'll laugh about it.
Yeah, exactly. So,
remember that? We've been waiting for this, Henry. Yeah, you know, Dad, really, your creepy friend John always scares the shit out of me. Lord Jermaine Retail, who's always up...
Hey, right on.
Indeed. Always up for a new episode of Word Balloon. If you had the opportunity to be the core writer, Matt, of some sort of event book, would you take it, or are you not really interested at the time?
Oh, sure. It was fun doing...
Dark Avengers?
X-Men Dark Avengers.
Yeah.
The Utopia book was a lot of fun. Yeah, no doubt. It seems like a shit ton of work and a lot of pressure, but no, sure, it sounds fun. You know, it's running a marathon. You know,
I love the back issue analysis you did for Doom Patrol and Simonson's Thor for Comic Foundry magazine. When can we see you do something like that again?
Oh gosh, that was always sort of born of resisting doing something that I had to do. You know what I mean? You can always tell when I'm procrastinating because suddenly my blog has a lot of content. And you can always tell when I'm working because my blog is not updated at all. I don't know. It'd be fun. It'd be fun to do. That the John Broome stuff was a blast. I don't know. Ultimately, it comes down to my thought process. Like, oh, hey, maybe I should update my blog. Or I'm just going to go chase Henry around the front yard a little bit. You know, the next time I'm stuck on a story point, maybe I'll get back to something like that. It's fun to do, but ultimately I know not the most productive use of my time.
We stay in North Carolina for a question from Dirty Harrington of Hope Mills. Really huge fan of both you guys. We're Balloon Casing Company at work, and pretty much everything Fraction does blows my mind. My question, though, is about this bit from an interview I read with Matt on CBR. Oh, this is where I get to be like on Meet the Press. Let me read the quote.
Oh. Okay. I'm not sweating. You're sweating.
Exactly.
Why are you sweating?
Nathan Thurm.
Is it me or is it him? It's him.
Clearly.
It's him.
Awesome. Let's see. What was your thinking behind bringing back Psylocke's original body, only to fry it and put her back in her second one? Nothing against Agent Psylocke, I'm just curious. And your answer was, to be brutally honest, I saw more value in bringing a character of color into the book than yet another white face. When I came in, there were a whole lot of dudes and a whole lot of white folk around. I wanted very much to diversify the genders and the colors of the team somewhat without turning the thing into a Benetton ad or the cast of Voyager or whatever. So based on that, Dirty Harrington asks, does a Caucasian woman in an Asian woman's body really count? I love everything you do, but that comment just rubs me wrong. I could be missing something from the Psylocke character because I'm not a big X-Books guy, but I was just wondering if you had any more justification for the decision.
No, I don't read the books. but
what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's sort of the question's not really that simple. The answer's not really that simple. We didn't just bring the body back to fry it. It was a lot more complicated than that. She is, in essence, in a synthetic body. She's two people synthesized into one person in one body that's been synthesized. She is a synthetic identity of a couple of different people in a couple of different bodies to form a kind of third personality in mm-hmm. a third body, visually predominant as Asian, with certain Asian characteristics. I mean,
she's Tuvix, like on Voyager.
I mean, she's a oh my God! How dare you, sir?
Well, I was sharing on your Voyager.
Okay, you sir.
That's my favorite Star Trek thing.
It's she's a synthesis of different characters and their histories, their lives, their memories, and their ethnicities. So it's not just I'm a white woman in an Asian body.
Gotcha.
Which is sort of how that excerpt, not that it was, clearly context was provided, but it sounds like, oh yeah, she's a white woman trapped in an Asian body. It's not that. And between her reappearance, the Psylocke miniseries of this past year, and where we're going in the future, as she is able to kind of, you know, she had the bad luck of coming back before like two crossovers. So as we can focus on her a little more, we're going to see her identity in question and in crisis, and this kind of developing synthesis of personalities where you've got these two minds created into one, and he, you know, it's not like there's two people trapped in there or anything, but like there's her memories and my memories. You know what I mean? There's
sure.
kind of there's a difference between. We're going to see her as we're looking to kind of because originally that's what happened was she was a white woman in an Asian
right.
body, and that was maybe a little tacky. So we're looking for a way to not necessarily undo it. Now she's white. There you go. Rest easy, America. It's okay. We made her white again. You know, I wanted a character to visually have a sense of some ethnicity beyond, you know, white folk.
I'm with you.
Of any given stripe. But to make the character more than just, I'm once again, but you know, a mere white woman trapped in an Asian woman's body. So it's a synthetic identity, racially, personally, historically, and physically. Even her power set is different, for God's sake. So it's not quite that black or white, if you'll excuse the expression.
I'm with you.
And hopefully as we come out of Second Coming, we get to see the kind of complexities that arise from her character now that she is this kind of unified, synthesized whole.
All right. And then secondly,
she was, you know, gallivanting around multiple realities and all this other stuff, too. So, I mean, it was kind of a big scramble of a thing to all come
okay.
together.
Secondly, with you taking over Thor, is there any chance Eric Masterson could make an appearance? Thunderstrike.
Was he the guy that played Trapper John's buddy when Parnell Roberts played Trapper John? Who was there? Nothing planned immediately.
Okay. Very nice. And he apologizes if the question seemed rude or dumb. He really enjoys
it. No. It is. And I didn't mean to quite make his life. But no. It's much. I hope it's a much more complicated situation than that. And I hope it's a much richer answer than it's okay. It's a white woman in an Asian body. And keep reading to see if we pull it off. You know?
Well, and it's going to play
or
to
start her. Reading if, as the guy's not really an X-Men fan, so maybe start reading and see if we pull it off.
Well, and it'll play to her name as well. I mean, that's kind of perfect for a character that is named Psylocke. I think so.
It works. I hope it was meant to take all this stuff and put it together in one person. So we'll see if we pull it off.
Dave 0923. Hey, guys, happy Fraction.
That is his PIN number, by the way.
We can now hack into his ATM machines.
Yes,
that's
exactly,
great.
Exactly.
Happy Fraction's finally getting a Q&A show. He's one of the best Word Balloon guests, so he deserves it. I completely agree.
That's true. I am, and I do. That's very true.
It's true.
Second question.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Your run on Iron Fist is one of my favorite books of all time. I'm proud to say it was one of those books I picked up from issue one and stuck with it up until the end. But one of the things that really made the book as magical an experience as it was David Aja's incredible art. Do you have any plans of working with him again anytime soon? Yeah, big fan.
We came close, and I opened my big mouth only to watch it go away. We were supposed to do a thing, a little... a Mandarin thing.
Ooh, that would have been cool.
I got excited. Yeah, but he's going to have... Actually, the baby might be here by now. He's having his second child. He had a couple of things that just...
Very nice.
...ended up being too much work, and he wasn't going to be able to do it, so we had to back out, unfortunately, after I had made the mistake of saying we were working together.
Everybody on the Iron Fist project was fantastic, seriously. Including Dwayne and the artist that Dwayne had after Travel you and Ed were done,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
So...
Dwayne and Travel were great.
Yeah.
So I would love to work with David again. Unfortunately, won't be on this Iron Man Iron Man special. But we'll see. The first opportunity we have, I'm going to jump on it.
If you could take one of your Marvel collaborators and work with them on a creator-owned book, who would it be, and what genre would it be?
Well, how about that? How about David Aja? There are a lot of answers to that question. I would work with pretty much anybody I've worked with before. I would love to work with again, but I'd love to do something with David, creator owned. We've talked about it a little bit, so we'll see.
All right, Spidey 616 actually asked about that Mandarin David Aja product, so we've just answered that, Spidey, and I will move on to your second question.
Yeah, sorry, I got excited and I opened my big mouth.
Not
and,
at all. No, that...
I don't even know that I'm allowed to say who is drawing it now that it's being drawn. I don't know if they haven't announced it yet. So,
okay,
the announcement will be coming soon. It is. It looks terrific. It looks great. While I regret David not drawing it, I couldn't be more happy with how it's turning out. So it looks terrific. And hey, it's Mandarin. Mandarin's back. Drop your cocks and grab your socks. Mandarin's back. Which is actually the name of the special. I don't know if Marvel's going to call it that or not.
But in your head, that's what it's called.
That should belong in the cover. Just imagine a Ryan Hughes design cover screaming. Drop your cocks, grab your socks, it's a Mandarin.
And so will that be announced, you think, during con season in terms of when that annual will be scheduled?
It's got to be announced soon. Maybe it's in, like, the next preview. I mean, it's got to be announced very soon.
Okay.
Yeah, it's coming.
After Second Coming, will John Sublime and his group be playing a role in your next arc of Uncanny X-Men?
Not in the arc immediately following Second Coming, but we haven't heard the last of those guys. We haven't seen the last of... Just those guys are coming back.
Very cool. Jason Hart.
To bulk build up a... some new villains with his sort of foot soldiers and all the kind of plot threads that we pick up and hint at and don't quite resolve, as with everything else that's been picked up but not quite resolved on first blush in my X run will be dealt with down the road.
So excellent.
Somewhere in the 530s that stuff should come back.
Very cool. Jason Hart from Cincinnati. John and Matt, always puts a smile on my face to see some fractioned
Jason
work.
Jason from Cincinnati, also a disastrously unpopular HBO series. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I never watched that, John from Cincinnati. Was that a good show?
I liked it.
I know pockets of people that liked it, yeah, but, you know.
I have my own theories and my own interpretations of it. It's kind of like Milch's Twin Peaks.
Interesting.
But it is clearly an intensely personal show for the guy. I don't know that it's entirely successful. Certainly interesting. I kind of want to check the DVD out to see like what the commentary is like. It's fun. You should check it out.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was just thinking maybe I should check out the DVD. So let's see. He says, as someone said earlier, for anyone who hasn't read your Thor one-shots, Matt, they're absolutely worth picking up. So here come my questions. He's a burgeoning comic writer, working with a few artists. This is like how a Penthouse Forum letter starts. I'm a burgeoning comic writer in a small Midwestern town.
I know you're not going to believe this, but I was...
The following happened a minute.
Working third shift at the lingerie factory. I had a buddy in New York that for a while had a temp job as a night watchman.
Okay.
And he kept getting stationed in Victoria's Secrets.
Nice.
And so he made it his mission to touch every article of clothing in like the six biggest Victoria's Secret stores in Manhattan.
Outstanding.
So for a chunk of time in the late 90s, if you bought any article of clothing from a Victoria's Secret, my buddy touched it.
The seven women from New York that listen to Word Balloon are going, ew!
Exactly. Dave touched your thong.
Nice. He's been working with a few artists on different stories, trying to court a few others for projects. And as you've now been through both creator-owned Marvel and Marvel projects, he's wondering how you go about contacting the artists you want to work with, and maybe more so how you did it in the early days. So how'd you hook up with writers? Yeah, for struggling artists or writers, how have you found your artists back in the day? Because, man, you hooked up with some great people, especially in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of orchestrated by the publishers usually, in some cases. But like Steven Sanders, for example, we went to school together.
Okay.
If there's an art school where you live, if there's an art conservatory or an art department near at a college or a community college, you'll be able to find somebody there who wants to draw comics. And that was the case of meeting Steven Sanders. He was in the illustration department, and I knew his work from his show. He had a gallery showing that I went to and loved and could tell by the way he drew that he would be into drawing comics. We had mutual friends who put us in touch. We had a couple of coffees, and away we went.
That's cool.
So like, there are going to be artists who are just as hungry and just as, like, there are artists out there who are going to be trying to figure out, like, God, how do I hook up with a writer, you know? Start in art departments of schools and go from there.
Did, for Rex Mantooth?
That was kind of...
I was going to ask.
That was, like... Andy, that was sort of like Andy's idea.
Okay.
I found out sort of much later. Andy had sort of had the idea for, like, Kung Fu Gorilla was sort of what he had called it. And went looking for someone to kind of help him with it. That was one of those things where Andy kind of, that was the root of Andy's idea, much to my surprise.
Very cool. Andy Kuhn. That's really neat.
Yes, the mighty Andy Kuhn. We've talked about you've not seen the end of Rex from the two of us.
That'd be great.
We had some fun conversations the last convention season. We'll see where we are as the year continues.
Andy's a good man. That'd be great. Let's see.
It's amazing too what Andy's been able to accomplish for an alcoholic pederast who's been five times convicted and now released. On work furlough.
That's why he keeps moving from state to state. That's okay. That makes sense now.
Yeah. And it's also partly an effect of the chemical castration. It kind of loses stuff, like geography. But no, Andy is a real success story. From his rock bottom on To Catch a Predator to today, he is... he's an example of what therapy and rehabilitation can mean for the criminal pervert, and I couldn't be more proud to be associated with him.
We salute you, Andy. Thank you. I assume now with Marvel, you go through an editor. Do you have much say in who the artist will be for your projects?
Not really. No, not particularly. I suppose if I threw a shit fit and sort of I might be able to. Sometimes I'm permitted. Sometimes there'll be a project where, like, hey, there are a couple of guys that might have openings. Are there, like, in the case of Salva on Iron Man, there were, like, a couple of different artists that they could have placed on it. They're like, do you have a feeling one way or the other? But no, for the most part, that's kind of, you know, it's like I said earlier, it's not my day to run the company, and that's kind of a good mantra to keep in your head. It's, especially having come out of, like, independent stuff where you have to package everything yourself. At Marvel, there are people who do that. You know, my job is to produce scripts at Marvel and answer questions like that when I'm asked. But for the most part, I try not to worry myself about it and just try to keep my head down and produce the work.
And for your new creator-owned work, have you found any approaches that work well in contacting artists you haven't previously met, or anything that seemed like a faux pas looking back on the way you did it?
Yes. Let's see. That's a fascinating two-part question. I'm lucky now that I've got a body of work. I can run into people at shows or well, like on Twitter or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I can kind of meet people now, but I'm lucky that I've got a body of work that kind of serves as an introduction and a calling card, and that's been really great, and I've met some amazing people that way, and hopefully future collaborators on creator-owned stuff that way, which is really, really awesome. Yes, when I used to work retail, I used to work at Heroes Are Hard to Find, America's Comic Store, Charlotte, North Carolina, and work Heroes Con every year and got to know pros that way. And in fact, there are still writers and professionals who remember me from my time at Heroes Con. James Robinson, for an example.
Cool.
Who I believed and still believe, hung the moon, remembers me from my days working retail, which is kind of hilarious. So there was a pro in particular who I had met at Heroes, and in my, you know, you just kind of have to do it. Everybody does it. I believe everyone does it. You think, well, this guy would totally work with me, and you write a script and you send it to them. And it's under the guise of, hey, can I get any notes you might have on this completely finished, completely polished, full-length comic script? And, hey, what if you drew it? Wouldn't that be awesome? Ha ha! But it's a thing you have to do, that kind of blind Ed Woody and confidence and courage that you have to have and just throw yourself out there. I will never say the name of the pro who I did that to. I have not seen him in a couple few years. He is still working. He is tremendously talented, amazingly gifted. I would love to work with him. I don't know that he knows that Matt from Heroes, that Matt Frichman has grown up to be Matt Fraction, if that makes sense.
I understand.
Like, I don't know if he remembers or not. I certainly will never remind him.
Gotcha.
But, you know, it's the kind of thing you got to do. It's that sort of, like, balls out, fuck it, let's see what happens kind of thing that I think everybody does. So what I will say about that now is whenever people send me scripts like that, I can't legally read them as it exposes me to any number of lawsuits, but I admire the chutzpah it takes to just fucking rock out with your cock out like that, you know. Everyone, editors especially, who lollygag is very, listen, no editor wants to miss discovering the next Alan Moore, and in my experience, editors never ever resent that they've been sent things to read. They just simply do not have the time or the need. And any editor that's getting paid to put their work together is kind of functioning on what fire needs to get put out today.
Sure.
So don't get discouraged. The best thing you need to do is I believe the best thing that can be done is find an artist and produce work. And rather than send scripts, send comics. You know, get your stuff done. It shows that you've got the discipline too to get stuff done. That you can meet deadlines, that you can get this stuff produced. That's the best thing you can do is start producing comics and showing it to people.
Do you think it's better now, especially with the explosion of webcomics, to still hand a pamphlet to somebody versus...
Oh, Yeah, absolutely. There's no standard on web comics, you know.
I understand. Well, it's the same with podcasts. Anyone can do one, frankly.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's sure.
Pod trash.
No, it's true, man. Hey.
But, you know, it especially if you're looking, if you're trying to work for Marvel, you know, or DC, someone who is in the paper superhero comic book business, producing a paper superhero comic book is maybe not the worst way for them to evaluate your work. That said, I know there are standards, and I know like CB Sapolsky, they're putting out like a How to Break into Comics the Marvel Way, like
yes.
mini series right now that kind of expresses that much more clearly than I could. There are procedures, there's operational stuff to do, but I believe producing a comic, if nothing else, to give to, listen, this is what I did. Anytime something with my name on it came out, I made sure to give it to editors I admired. And that was how Axel Alonso found Last of the Independents, and that was how I started to work at Marvel, was Axel knew my work. And I came up to Axel in San Diego, and he had edited, he's a fucking legend. He had every book
sure.
you loved in the 90s, Axel edited.
Absolutely. I agree. Both at Vertigo and at Marvel, yeah, when he finally made the switch, too.
Yeah, exactly. And at that point, yeah, that was, you know, and that was 2002, 2003 when that came out.
I guess so, yeah, you're right. I thought it was in the 90s, but you're right. It was the early 2000s that he made the
you
jump.
Know, so I was you know, I made sure to give my book to Axel because, God damn it, I wanted my name and his name to be on a book together.
Sure.
And now look what happened.
Well, and Last of the Independents, that was a hell of a calling card, man. I mean, that was the first thing of yours that I read, and it blew my mind, so.
Thank you so much. And, you know, and two was clearly kind of up Axel's alley, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So that made sense, too. But, yeah, listen, I don't think you've got a better calling card than finished produced work. I think that's going to be the best. Most, if nothing else, somebody can sit and read it on the airplane and think, oh, shit, this guy's pretty good.
Very cool. All right, Matt.
So, we done? Is that it?
No, I think, well, the only other thing I could think of, obviously, is Kitty is Back.
Oh, yeah.
And that came out this week, so what can you say about her at Kitty Pride now that she's back?
You know, I did that. I did. I had Magneto. I'll tell you this. Here's a special secret for you. There was a line in Uncanny X-Men 522 that was generously provided to me by... Pulitzer Prize winning author Michael Chabon, when his like a year and a half ago, one of his daughters sent me a scan of Kitty Pryde with the email that said, "Hey Matt, maybe you should bring her back. Just think about it." And so when it came time, I wrote him and said, "Look, you know, she's coming back," and I knew I had a moment where I wanted Magneto to say something to her in Yiddish. I wanted him to sort of give her a nice grandpa thing to say, you know, to a nice Jewish girl like Kitty Pryde. And so Michael helped me with the Yiddish that he says to her, which is something to the effect of, you should eat, sweetheart. You're skinny. I could dig it up in my email. I don't have it off the top of my head. But anyway, so that little chunk of Yiddish that Magneto speaks to her before he goes into his coma was generously... I was generously assisted by Pulitzer Prize winning author Michael Chabon.
And you're sustaining the moment of truth because unfortunately she's back, but not completely back apparently. And
yeah, exactly. There's a reason why the story was called Ghostly.
Ouch, babe.
Yeah,
Buffy and Angel destined to be apart.
Complications. You know what I mean? Now here's the question: how come she doesn't fall through the earth?
Anticipating the talkback, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I already saw some. Well, I don't want to give credit to. I don't want to acknowledge the existence of assholes. Anyway, she's back, and I love her. And she doesn't have much to do in Second Coming because you know she can't hold shit. But coming out of Second Coming, I've got a storyline called. I don't know if I'm allowed to. I don't know if I've said it or not. I don't know if it's going to be called this or not. Anyway, we got a storyline coming up, and she plays a big part of that. And yeah, I love her. I adore her. Also, Wolverine thinks beer is a vegetable.
Fair enough.
And, there you go.
And what? And is there anything you can say about your book's participation in Second Coming?
It's very much like Messiah was, where it's really a chapter to chapter kind of thing. It is my three chapters, and then the finale which I think might be a jam issue where a bunch of us all kind of work on it, really are discrete parts of a large story and would make for lousy reading isolated. So either pay attention to the previously, update on that first page and it'll get you caught up to speed, or you check it all out, or just sort of, do your best. But yeah, so I have these weirdly quiet issues. Well, 525 is pretty big. 525 has a lot of kind of set pieces, but I have a couple of heavy emotional moments, which is odd. There's a ton of pyrotechnics, but I tend to have a couple of the issues, the big resonant scenes where we're sort of dealing with the ramifications of this stuff, like really character-driven, emotionally charged sort of aftermath sequences. But it's just, it's been a fucking bummer to write. It's been really like, oh, God, I am ready for the heroic age. I am so ready for the heroic age, physically, spiritually, mentally. I'm ready for the great leap forward, as Billy Bragg said.
And anything else you could say in general about the X-Men and the heroic age?
It's this sort of first kind of like, I guess it's been like 5 years. I don't know how long it's been, but like it's kind of, Messiah Complex was really sort of a definitive statement from kind of the current editorial stewardship from Axel and Nick and those guys. It was sort of this initial moment, and this story wraps that up. And this is the bookend to this. There's a you can draw a straight line from House of M to Messiah Complex to Second Coming, 1, 2, and 3. This is the end of a very large, very operatic story, and the beginning of another one. It's huge, and coming out, this next arc is gets back to a very classic X-Men. It gets back to a very traditional X-Men. It gets back to a sort of a historic sort of X-Men, and at the same time takes the book into a place it's never been before, with a very new kind of reality and a new status quo. They're still in California. They're still in San Francisco.
Okay.
That the West Coast is still very much a part of the book. But there's a sea change, a real sea change going on with who mutants are because of the events of Second Coming. And it's fresh and it's exciting. We've never gotten to tell these kinds of stories before. So I'm really excited. Knowing where we've been going since I came on the book, this is kind of like, all right, now here we go. This is the stuff, This is kind of, I've been waiting for this a long time.
Like the Avengers.
A lot of these pieces that we moved onto the board are here for a reason. You're going to start seeing what those reasons are very, very quickly.
Sure, and as you say, the events in the X-Men have been on the same timeline as the Avenger events. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it is time to get back to basics and everything, so that'll be
interesting. Everybody, the good guys are just getting the shit hammered out of them. the good news is when that happens, I think it makes for great stories. It reminds us why we love these fricactic stories in the first place. But when it's done, when they get through it, you gotta crush bones to make strong bones.
Sure.
Everyone has been disassembled. Everyone has been boiled down to their heroic core, their very essence. And now we get to see them, get to really see them shine. And it's a really fun, it's a really exciting time. We're going to get back to some great, big, epic fucking stories, man.
And we leave part one right there. So that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Part two is coming up next Tuesday, but there will be a new episode of Word Balloon in between. And that's why it's important to subscribe to the Word Balloon feed. So make sure you check out our RSS feed and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Lots of great guests coming up. C2E2 is coming up as well, and we'll be covering that in force. So if you don't want to miss an episode, make sure you subscribe to the Word Balloon feed. And thank you to those of you who do, and I hope more of you will join in. That'll do it for this episode. Thanks for listening. John Suntress reminding you that today's episode was brought to you by the Summit City Convention happening May 22nd in Fort Wayne, Indiana at the Grand Wayne Center. It's going to be a great day among the people that you can see. Friends of the show like Andy Jewett, Art Baltazar, Chris Burnham, Dave Wachter, Jim Heffron, Steve Bryant, Hillary Barta, Katie Cook, Matt Kent, Mike Norton, Tim Seeley, Robert Atkins. Jim Rugg is going to be there. Looking forward to seeing Jim. Zach Crucy, of course, is going to be there. It's going to be a great day. Dozens of creators will be there, and really some great art. You'll definitely want to be there to check out the Summit City Comic Con. I'm going to be there May 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's being brought to you by our friends at Discount Comic Book Service, dcbservice.com, and In Stock Trades at instocktrades.com. If you're in the tri-state area, you'll want to check it out. The Summit City Comic Con, May 22nd at the Grand Wayne Center in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hope to see you there. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, or of course at the Word Balloon message board. Come to wordballoon.com, check out our archive of shows, some recent shows you might have missed. Phil Hester was just on talking about all the books that he's been writing lately. We also had a wonderful conversation with John Ostrander. Everything waiting for you at the Word Balloon Archive. If you come to the RSS feed or you check us out via iTunes, just subscribe to the feed that way, and you'll be guaranteed the old and new archive will be there for you. Lots of shows there. Also some video, too, waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Come check it out. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.